And good afternoon. Welcome to Health Action. I'm Bob Lederer. And this afternoon, on this very hot and humid day here in the Big Apple, we have two segments for you. In our first part, we are going to be continuing with a theme we've had for several programs, give you the latest update on the struggle of disabled people, both locally and nationally, for accessible housing and the obstacles that they've had to face from the home building industry. And in our second segment, we'll be discussing the adverse health effects of workplace surveillance and monitoring, a trend that's becoming increasingly widespread in this country. So let's get directly to our first topic. And as regular listeners may know, for many years now, there's been a struggle going on by people with various kinds of physical disabilities to have the construction of housing be built to standards that allow for access both in the outer doorways, in the bathrooms, and in other parts of the house to people who may have various disabilities, whether that means they're in a wheelchair or have other problems with mobility. And this is a very real life and death and health issue in enabling people to be able to go about their lives and meet their personal needs. And the struggle has been particularly acute here in New York State in recent weeks as an arm of the Pataki administration in Albany has been trying to roll back a very progressive set of standards that were adopted by the state in 1984. And with us to discuss this in the studio, I'm pleased to be joined by Frieda Zames, who is the Vice President of Disabled in Action of New York City. And she's also the co-author, along with her sister, Doris Zames Fleischer, of the new book, The Disabled Rights Movement from Charity to Confrontation, by Temple University Press. Frieda, thanks very much for joining us this afternoon.
It's my pleasure.
So lay out for us a little bit of before we get into the general issues, tell us about your personal story, because you are sitting here in a motorized scooter and you have a disability yourself, and tell us how that happened.
Well, I contracted polio when I was 2.5, and I walked with crutches and braces until about 10 or 15 years ago. As you get older, the polio gets, there's something called post-polio syndrome. You get weaker, and walking became too difficult for me, so now I use a scooter. There are various advantages in using a scooter. I can go faster, and I don't get tired like I used to when I walked. I drive a car, and I worked, I'm now retired, I worked as a math professor at New Jersey Institute of Technology for 27 years. Before that, I worked at Metropolitan Life Insurance Company for 12 years, so I've, you know, and now. For the last 25, almost 30 years, I've been active in the disability rights movement. I thought this is a movement I can really do something for. I mean, I certainly supported other civil rights movements, but this is something I thought I could add something.
And so tell us, both from your own personal experience and those of your colleagues in the disability rights movement, what are the issues as far as accessible housing, and what have been the obstacles to obtaining those that goal?
Well, housing is a problem for everybody in New York City, certainly, and around the country. But for people with disabilities, it's even an additional problem because you not only need low cost, low rents, and many, a very high percentage of people with disabilities are poor because it's so hard to get jobs if you have a disability. So we really need low cost, but we also, many of us, need accessible, wheelchair accessible, or at least not a housing that doesn't have steps in front. Even when I walked, it would have been hard for me to have steps in front of my house, although I did, and when I was a child. But it's very difficult. So you look for housing that has at least has no steps and is as accessible as possible. When you're in a scooter or a wheelchair, you really need accessible housing, and that's very hard to come by. So it's very hard for people to be independent if they can't find an apartment or a house that they can live in.
And what is the status of the regulations in New York State that guarantee a certain degree of accessibility?
Well, the state had this wonderful accessibility standard that 100% of all new housing would have to be adaptable, which basically means that it could be made, an apartment could be made accessible with very little effort or cost. But the 100% meant that a person with a disability could move into any apartment. Now they want to go down to what is called the International Builders Building Code, and that IBC, which would mean only 2% accessible. Now the problem with that is that they're not going to leave these 2% unoccupied, so they could be occupied by people who don't need the accessibility. And when somebody needs an apartment that's accessible, they can't throw that family or person out of his apartment. So what happens is there ends up to be no apartments for people who need accessibility. So we are really fighting this. The New York State standard is way ahead of the country, and New York City even has a stricter standard, and we want to keep it that way. I mean, eventually we would like the whole country to adopt that standard. It makes sense. It's not that much more expensive, and it's not only people in wheelchairs, but people, as they age, there tends to be more disability. We want it's better for people to stay in their own homes. And we hope that, you know, that it just doesn't make sense, because if they can't, then they have to go to nursing homes and things like that.
Right, which is actually a dilemma that I made reference to on the last program, that my own mother is now facing that very tough choice, because she has advancing Parkinson's disease, and it's increasingly difficult, since she is in a wheelchair most of the time, for her to maneuver around the 40-year-old house that has no accessible provisions in it. So tell us now, this fight about the degree of standards guaranteeing accessibility is being fought out in an obscure state agency called the Building Codes Council. But what is the force behind them that is really lobbying strongly against maintaining this access?
We think it's the National Association of Home Builders that, according to the to Ragged Edge, which is a disability rights magazine, the National Association of Home Builders has systematically worked to prevent the passage of every and any piece of legislation that might mandate any access feature in housing accommodating people with disabilities, no matter how minimum. And we think that is where the problem lies. They spend a lot of money on lobbying, and they give these legislatures a lot of this money for their campaigns. It's hard to fight them, especially, by the way, we are trying to fight them in terms of, if there's a problem with the, if the codes gets passed, it hasn't been passed yet. It's only been passed by the Codes Council. But if it is passed, we're going to try to get a bill. And the Assembly has all unanimously, the State Assembly has unanimously signed on to this bill. But the Senate, if the Senate tends to be more Republican, hasn't. So this is our attack. After all, next year is an election year.
Right. Now, I know another initiative that your organization, Disabled in Action of Metropolitan New York, was involved in recently, actually on July 10th, was a demonstration outside the local offices of the local affiliate of the National Association of
Homeless.
That's
right.
Tell us about that.
We participated. About 15 or 20 of us participated in the demonstration at the local affiliate of this office because and in fact, it was part of a WBAI demonstration. But although our main interest was to show our anger at this association, because their main interest is just to make more money, and it isn't even that much more. Of course, altogether, it may end up because they had the whole country, but it's really against the trend because we want to get people out of nursing homes. There's something called the Olmstead decision where the Supreme Court decided that people in nursing homes have a right to get out if they can function in the community. And besides services, they need housing. And housing is very, very important. In order to do this, if we can't provide the housing, people have to stay in. It's much more expensive for the society to keep people in nursing homes than to have people in their own homes.
Well, that demonstration that our guest Frieda Zanes from Disabled in Action alluded to was just actually one of 12 that occurred simultaneously around the country on July 10th outside the local offices of the National Association of Home Builders. And the following is a news report that aired on our sister station, Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley, on July 11th.
This is concerned with the direction of Pacifica Radio, the nation's oldest and largest public radio network, turned out across the nation to protest the actions of Tim Ford, the acting chair of the Pacifica Foundation. The target of the activist's wrath was not only Ford, but also his employer, the National Association of Home Builders, a Washington, D.C.-based real estate developers organization, which protesters say epitomizes the corporate direction in which Pacifica has been lately headed. Vanessa Tate has this report. Picketers turned up outside National Association of Home Builders regional offices in a dozen cities, including New York, Boston, Atlanta, Houston, Minneapolis, Los Angeles, Washington, D.C., and here in Walnut Creek in the San Francisco Bay Area. They hope to force Ken Ford, who is a manager at the NAHB, to resign from the Pacifica board. Critics say Ford supported the 1999 lockout at Pacifica's Berkeley station, KPFA, and the mass firings at Pacifica's New York station, WBAI, last December, as well as changes in Pacifica's bylaws, which made the board self-selecting and reduced community involvement in the national radio network. Ford also shocked Pacifica supporters recently when he said he would turn over listener mail critical of the board's policies to the FBI for investigation. John Sheridan of the Coalition for Democratic Pacifica said the picketers wanted to educate Ford's NAHB colleagues about his actions at Pacifica.
As Ken Ford's employer, this is one way that the community that supports KPFA in such large numbers can actually come out as a community and make our dismay, our displeasure at Ken Ford's outrageous action, to be destructive and venal, and illegal action, known.
Ford specifically denies charges from Pacifica reformers that he has violated listeners' trust and squandered their donations by paying a team of lawyers to defend the board against pending lawsuits brought by Pacifica constituents, as well as $500,000 for armed guards and a public relations firm during the KPFA lockout, and tens of thousands more for a surveillance system recently installed at WBAI, Ken Ford.
That is not true. As a matter of fact, what was done is take corrective steps to make sure the funds given in honesty by the listeners are used for the benefit and operation and maintenance of the network as a whole.
Ford is also angered by the picketing of his employer, the National Association of Home Builders.
Well, I think it's misappropriate, misapplied. The employer that I work for has no stake in this, and why they are unduly targeted, harassed, and essentially violated does not make sense. If the purpose's mission and what we have stood for in the past is fair play, honesty, and non-threatening or overbearing, power-hungry, tyrannical action, then, you know, this makes no sense. The people who I work for, as well as my co-workers, have no stake in this. They have not been involved, and nor do they want to have any involvement in it. But here again, for whatever reason, it chose to go after people's place of employment.
But Pacifica activists say that protesting Ford's connection to the IHB is appropriate because it highlights what they call the pro-corporate shift in the network's politics over the last several years. Several of Pacifica's current board members, including Ford and John Murdoch, who is an attorney at an anti-labor law firm, do not represent the progressive values of the network's listeners, according to Ursula Rudenberg of the New York-based Pacifica campaign.
We don't feel that Mr. Ford has the credentials to be on the Pacifica National Board. He works for quite a conservative organization that lobbies against many of the issues that actually Pacifica traditionally is fighting for.
The NAHB operates one of the country's largest political action committees, working on behalf of real estate developers and opposing regulations to protect the environment, renters, and the disabled. Bill Singleton is a researcher at the Center for Responsive Politics in Washington, D.C.
In the 1999 to 2000 election cycle, the National Association of Home Builders spent $2.34 million on campaign contributions. 63% of that money went to the Republican Party or to Republican candidates. The lobbying records do indicate that the National Association of Home Builders was lobbying on a wide range of policies, most of which were related to deregulation. They were lobbying on issues like housing accessibility, environmental protection, the minimum wage, and even things as mundane as low-flow toilets.
The NAHB has lobbied against the Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act, and successfully defeated two Sierra Club-backed voter initiatives on urban sprawl in Colorado and Arizona. Janet Stone is Livable Communities Program Director for the San Francisco-based Green Belt Alliance.
What we see in practice is a lot of the home builders that would be members of NAHB have no problems with building sprawl housing in the suburbs in the Bay Area. That would be, by sprawl housing, I mean lower density housing in open space, greenfield areas.
Activists attempting to change the balance of power on Pacifica's board recently forced the resignations of board chair David Acosta, treasurer Michael Palmer, and board member Carolyn Van Putten. With those resignations, the Pacifica board now has a block of 7 members who support the status quo against 5 board members who want democratic reform. The board majority has scheduled a meeting on July 17th to consider 5 new members, among them former Washington, D.C. Mayor Marion Barry and comedian Dick Gregory.
And again, that was a report on July 7th that aired on our sister station KPFA, produced by Free Speech Radio News, which is a daily newscast of Pacifica reporters against censorship that airs on more than 40 community radio stations nationwide. And you can access their reports directly at www.fsrn.org. That's FSRN for Free Speech Radio News.org. And we're now joined on the phone by one of the activists who you just heard quoted in that report, Ursula Rudenberg. Ursula is a media activist with the Pacifica Campaign to Stop the Corporate Takeover and is a band volunteer at WBAI. Ursula, thanks for joining us on the program.
Hi, Bob.
So tell us, why did the Pacifica Campaign organize these 12 national demonstrations on July 10th in conjunction with disability rights groups and others?
The National Day of Action was organized to send a message to Ken Ford that we feel that he should resign immediately, and that to demonstrate to him that people all over the country feel the same way. There were 12 cities participated in this action. the actions were not organized directly by the Pacifica campaign. We did put out a call across the country to find out who was interested in protesting, and these 12 areas around the country contact us and told us they wanted to carry out autonomous actions to demonstrate their wish that Ken Ford resign from the Pacifica National Board.
Now, one of the points that Mr. Ford made in that report was that he believes it's unfair to target his employer, the place at which he is a manager, when the real issues are with the Pacifica National Board, on which he serves as an unpaid member, as vice chair and now acting chair. How do you respond to his statement?
I think it's the kind of statement that on the surface sounds like it makes sense, but I think that it really has to be understood that what's happening at Pacifica and with the disability rights groups and the environmental groups, there's a context for this. And the bottom line is that Mr. Ford belongs to an organization which runs really counter to the mission of Pacifica, the traditional mission of Pacifica, of fighting for human rights, and has also proceeded to behave this way on the Pacifica National Board. And we have asked Mr. Ford many times in many different ways. I mean, not necessarily myself, but the whole national movement that is protesting against the actions of the ruling majority on the board right now at Pacifica, they have been asked in many different ways to cease and desist their actions at the board. And Mr. Ford has, in particular, shown contempt for the legitimate protests that people have registered. He's been known at one board meeting to tear up a written document that was presented to him expressing concerns. And he has most recently threatened to report protesters to the FBI. And so at this point, we feel that a message has to be sent to him in a form that he understands. And in the same vein, we do also protest the actions of the NAHB. Pacifica has traditionally spoken out for the oppressed and the voiceless, and we feel these are issues that absolutely agree with what Pacifica should be talking about.
And tell us what is the backdrop of the National Day of Action on July 10th. It was actually just the latest of a long list of actions that a lot of independent grassroots groups around the country have been taking against the NAHB. Can you give us some examples of other recent actions?
Yeah, there's been quite a few actions, and they seem to be growing as time goes on. Independent groups have been letting the NAHB know that we are going to continue to ask Mr. Ford to resign in many different venues. In early June, a banner was hung from the upper floor of the NAHB headquarters in Washington, D.C., and I think the banner said something effective, Ken Ford off the board, NAHB out of Pacifica. And a few days later, the NAHB had its national board meeting where some activists actually interrupted the meeting, shouting the announcement that Mr. Ford should resign. And simultaneously, a group of about 20 protesters picketed on the sidewalk in front of the hotel where the meeting was, chanting and carrying signs and bringing the police as well as Mr. Ford himself to come and ask them to stop, which of course they didn't, because we are asking Mr. Ford to stop doing what he's doing, and he has not stopped.
And maybe you could interrupt for a second to ask you to specify in a little more detail what are the grievances about Mr. Ford's conduct as the vice chair of the Pacifica National Board.
Mr. Ford became vice chair of the Pacifica National Board in March of 2000 and actually continues to hold that position even though his own term at the Pacifica National Board expired on March of 2000. So he actually legally should no longer be here. And during his tenure, he and the ruling board that he has worked with have carried out an agenda of secrecy, censorship, power politics, intimidation, and workplace abuses, union busting, arbitrary firings, squandering of funds, and undercover manipulations, among many other things. And I'll give you a few examples. There's so many, I know we don't have a lot of time. but I'll just highlight a few things that have happened under his tenure. Mr. Ford was instrumental in bringing about bylaw changes at the Pacifica National Board, which is the subject of three lawsuits currently in the state of California. And basically what they did was amend the bylaws of Pacifica Foundation to end elections of board members by local boards in the listening areas, and therefore becoming a self-selecting, top-down board, which really violates the principles of community output and democracy, which, for which Pacifica stands.
Now, let me just stop you there, because I want to turn back to Frieda Zames, the Vice President of Disabled in Action here in New York City. And she is also a former member of the local advisory board to WBAI, and in that capacity is a co-plaintiff in one of those three lawsuits that Ursula Rudenberg just mentioned against the, Ken Ford and the members of the board of directors who make up the current majority. Frieda, tell us why you became a co-plaintiff in that lawsuit.
Well, for one thing, I think the way this amendment was done was illegal.
Now, the amendment you're referring to?
I'm talking to the amendment where the they made a rule that you either belong to the national board or you belong to the local board. You cannot belong to both. That wasn't true in the past. Every two members of every local board was a member of the national board, and that made sense. But then they changed it, and it wasn't changed, I think, illegally or properly. Secondly, there are people on the Pacifica board, for instance, Ken Ford, who have terms have expired, or and they shouldn't be on the board anyway because they're inappropriate for the national board of Pacifica. When our term, local members members of the local board's term expired, as mine did, after 6 years, I left the board because we believe in obeying the bylaws. They should do the same.
Okay, and Ursula, we're coming to the final minutes here, so maybe you could wrap up what the issues are currently against the majority that at this point is down to six members of the people who have been in control of the Pacifica board and five of the people who call themselves dissidents, and tell us what the current issues are and what's happened recently and what comes next.
Well, one thing that has changed since the report that you played a minute ago by Free Speech Radio News is that Epstein, Becker & Green is no longer the law firm that's defending the Pacifica National Board. They have been fired by Bessie Wash in Washington, D.C., who is the executive director. And she has hired two new law firms, Fulbright and Jaworski, and Greg Craig. Greg Craig is the law firm that defended Clinton in the impeachment hearing. So they have brought in some very serious law firms to continue to fight this issue, and have, for all intents and purposes, said that they are soon going to hold a board meeting to nominate new members to the board. You have to remember that they nominate them. Local communities don't. And so really this is an effort to pack the board some more. So we're very concerned. It sounds like the power plays are continuing. And so we are planning another National Day of Action against the NAHB. We really want the NAHB to understand that we're serious about this. We want Ken Ford to back off, and we will be having another action on August 8th, and all of the areas that demonstrated before have expressed their desire to continue these protests, and other activist groups concerning disability rights, environmental, and also free speech activists, because Ken Ford is saying that legitimate protest is illegal, and he wants to send people to the FBI. That's outrageous, that he is willing to send his own listeners to the FBI. And so people want to continue protesting, and it sounds like there's going to be a few more cities added because other places like Boulder and Madison have registered their interest in also adding to the message. So that's August 8th. And if people, can I tell people where to call if they are interested? The Pacifica campaign number is 646-230-9588. Our website is pacificacampaign.org.
Can you repeat that?
Yeah. It's the number is 646-230-9588, and we're at pacificacampaign.org, or you can write to us at pacificacampaign@yahoo.com.
Okay, and just one final clarification. When you said there's a day of action and there have been other days of action, tell us about the nature of the action in terms of the charges that this movement has engaged in violence.
Okay, these actions, I want to say again, are really autonomously organized. The people doing it in their local communities based on their own issues with their own local activists. But the one thing they all obey and follow is our demand that these protests be nonviolent. We do not destroy property. We do not use racist or abusive language. And we make that very clear. And up to this day, nobody has engaged in such activities at any of these protests. And we want to make that very clear. At several of the areas where we protested, we encountered extremely alarmed security forces waiting for us. And they were all extremely pleased and amazed to find out that we were decent and wholesome people who were just voicing our protests in a very wholesome and democratic manner. And there was absolutely nothing dangerous about this crowd. The only danger that we have is that we tell the truth. And for people that do not want the truth to be told, that is dangerous, because we are asking them to stop doing what they're doing. And we are telling the truth.
Okay, and on that note, I want to thank you, Ursula Rudenberg, a media activist with the Pacifica Campaign to Stop the Corporate Takeover and a band volunteer here at WBAI. Thank you very much. And Frida Zames of Disabled in Action, why don't you give us the contact information for the ongoing advocacy that your group is doing on access to housing for the disabled?
Our phone number, Disabled in Action phone number, is 718-261-3737.
Can you repeat that?
718-261-3737. And our internet
web address
is www.disabledinaction.org.
That's www.disabledinaction.org. And I want to thank our guest, Frida Zames, Vice President of Disabled in Action in New York City and co-author of The Disability Rights Movement from Charity to Confrontation, available from Temple University Press. Thanks very much. And we're going to go to a music break, and when we return, we'll be discussing the adverse health effects of workplace surveillance and monitoring. Stay tuned.
¿A poco usted sabe qué hace temblor? Él me dice que más cuando se fue el plomón del techo, el plomón del techo se pasó que la luz el sol y la tierra se van.
The Palestinian reality? What's really happening in the Muslim lands? A new memoir by Professor Leila Ahmed? Or Muslim political candidates in the USA? These and more are questions you can hear discussed on Tahrir, WBAI's magazine of the Arab Muslim community. Marhaba, I'm Barbara Nimri Aziz, and I'd like you to join me and our Tahrir staff every Tuesday night at 9 o'clock. That's Tuesdays from 9 to 10 p.m. here on listener-sponsored WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. You're sure to find something new and sometimes controversy.
Welcome back to Health Action here on listener-supported, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York City, 99.5 FM. I'm Bob Lederer. And before we go to our second segment, I just had a final footnote on the preceding segment. This is really an interesting health aspect of the new attorneys that our radio network has just hired to defend itself against four lawsuits. And that law firm called Williams and Connolly represented Rupert Murdoch's Fox 13 TV station in Tampa Bay, Florida, in its defense against a suit by two investigative reporters who were fired after they refused to broadcast statements, which they considered to be untrue, about the safety of the milk additive bovine growth hormone, which is manufactured by Monsanto, a major Fox advertiser. And it's also interesting to note that Pacifica's new public relations firm, West Hill Partners, was founded by John Scanlon, the man who headed the tobacco industry's campaign to discredit whistleblower Jeffrey Wigand, whose story was depicted in the recent film The Insider. So just those two health notes. Now I want to turn to our next segment about the adverse health effects of workplace surveillance and monitoring. Now, according to a report by the American Management Association, a recent report, nearly 80% of major U.S. companies keep tabs on employees by checking their email, internet, or telephone connections, or by videotaping them at work, according to American Management Association's annual survey on workplace monitoring and surveillance. Active monitoring has skyrocketed in recent years, up from 35% in 1997. So that's from 35% to 80%. And then there's this quote, privacy in today's workplace is largely illusory. In this era of open space cubicles, shared desk space, network computers, and teleworkers, it's hard to realistically hold on to a belief in private space, unquote, said Ellen Bayer, the American Management Association's human resources practice leader. And then we have this note from a recent report on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now, quote, while management says that video cameras ensure security, they are overwhelmingly used to monitor the workers' every move and sometimes result in suspensions and firings. And surveillance is often used as a tool in politically charged situations, such as intimidating and inhibiting workers from union organizing. A few examples, workers at the Starbucks roasting plant in Kent, Washington, organized a union in October 99. Citing safety concerns, the company installed cameras all over the plant. But after the cameras were installed in the lunchroom, workers began to suspect the company was more concerned with spying than with safety. Another example, in August 99, AK Steel locked out the United Steelworkers of America from the Mansfield, Ohio plant after contract negotiations failed. Then a few weeks ago, the steel workers filed an unfair labor practice charge against the company. The workers say that AK Steel is using the surveillance system not just for security purposes, but to videotape workers who are lawfully distributing literature. Now, all of this has its direct effect on health, and we have this information from the website of the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Quote, privacy, along with being a human right, facilitates the free creation and distribution of ideas. If there were no private space within a company, it would most certainly have a chilling effect on the possibilities for free speech and creative thought. Employee monitoring programs also have less tangible negative effects. In companies that engage in particularly invasive types of surveillance, such as keystroke monitoring, employees have far greater reported stress levels and are more vulnerable to other disorders, such as carpal tunnel syndrome. And finally, we have this report from entitled Invisible Eyes, Report on Video Surveillance in the Workplace by the Privacy Committee of New South Wales, Australia. And this is a very thorough review of the literature. And they write, quote, the conduct of constant video surveillance may also add to levels of stress and anxiety in the workplace. Some overseas studies have found that the overall impact of employment monitoring may be to decrease productivity because of these concerns. And one study of employees monitored by electronic surveillance in the U.S. concluded that surveillance and monitoring are major stress factors in the workplace, with monitored workers reporting boredom, high tension, extreme anxiety, and depression, anger, and severe fatigue, unquote. So those are some of the issues created by this growing trend, and it's one that we here at WBAI have even experienced recently with the installation of seven video cameras around our radio station. Some, not only has the union of staff workers here protested this, but several of the staff members, including myself, have taken to sometimes wearing masks at the station as a protest. So I now want to bring up as our first guest somebody who's been working on these issues for quite some time, and that is excuse me one second here. Okay, I'm sorry. That's Ellen Bravo, the co-director of 9 to 5, which is the National Association of Working Women, and she joins us by phone from Milwaukee. Thanks for being with us, Ellen.
My pleasure.
Tell us about this national trend in increasing workplace monitoring and surveillance and what effects it has.
Well, you know, I think the 80% figure speaks for itself. And if you think how common it is to hear now this call may be monitored for quality purposes, people have come to take it for granted. This is something that, in fact, represents listening in to your phone conversations. Our concern is that is several-fold. First of all, there are different kinds of monitoring. There's the surveillance camera at the 7-Eleven that's really there for safety purposes that I think the cashier behind the counter says, good, I'm glad to know that this camera's here and it helps, makes me feel safer. The best way of knowing if you're an employer whether you fall into that category is, are your workers grateful or are they angry and disturbed? Pretty much only, you know, those for whom this is a logical step, the workers will say thanks. This is a good thing. The second are people who, where there are monitors not asked for by the workers, but known to the workers. So this call may be monitored for quality purposes, generally indicates that the worker knows their call may be listened into. And the third are hidden, either cameras or monitors, where people don't know either when or whether their work is being under surveillance. And the added factor of finding that out, you know, adds a sort of shudder to what else is being done. Are my personal effects being gone through, et cetera. Spying is something we do to the enemy. And I think most workers don't want to be seen as the enemy and highly resent this kind of intrusion. For those who argue that it's for productivity purposes, you know, you just have to be a high school student learning how to type and remember every time your teacher came and stood and looked over your shoulder how many more mistakes you make. As one worker told us, 9 to 5 has an 800 number, and members all over the country, we've heard stories about this for years. And I was very moved by someone who said, it's like having a supervisor in your lap all day. Well, who wants that? It doesn't increase productivity. It increases stress. And for us, it's really a form of control. Good managers have lots of other ways and appropriate ways of supervising their employees and making sure that quality is maintained. This shouldn't be one of them.
Well, and Ellen Bravo of 9 to 5 mentioned the stress effects of this kind of monitoring, and we're joined by a second guest on the line who's an expert at studying that stress. That's Dr. Paul Landsbergis. He's assistant professor of community and preventive medicine at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. He's also associated with Mount Sinai's Occupational Medicine Clinic, and he's an expert on the health effects of workplace surveillance. Dr. Landsbergis, thank you for joining us today. Tell us what you've both experienced through your work at the clinic and your study of the literature on these health effects.
Yes, we've been looking at the health effects of job stress for years, and job stress certainly seems to contribute to a lot of conditions, psychological symptoms such as anxiety and depression, repetitive motion injuries, as you mentioned, carpal tunnel and tendinitis, and also to high blood pressure and heart disease. You know, we have to remember heart disease is still the number one cause of death in the U.S. And the research that's been done on electronic monitoring and surveillance and health effects seems to show, certainly as Ellen Bravo was saying, that, monitoring makes workplaces more stressful. What we see a lot of is that monitoring is associated with workplaces, job design in which there are greater job demands and pressures, lower job control, reduced use of skills on the job, less variety, less support from your supervisor. And these are the types of features of jobs that have been shown in studies all over the world to to increase stress and increase this risk of high blood pressure and heart disease.
Yeah, I really agree with that, and I think that the lack of control, often what's being listened for isn't whether or not you're mean to the customer, but whether you say a certain number of times some sales technique that you've been taught, some phrase that often is completely irrelevant, and you know the customer, in fact, would be much happier if you didn't ask. But nevertheless, you'll be punished as a worker if you don't, and I think that's what contributes to the stress. Employees who, in fact, care about customer satisfaction but feel that the mechanical way in which they're being required to hurry people off the phone or, you know, move them into some purchase that they may, in fact, not want to make contributes to that high level of stress.
And Ellen Bravo, I know you're familiar with a particular case that in which monitoring was used at a radio station in order to retaliate against some employees that had filed a discrimination complaint. Can you talk about that case?
This is a case where one woman had filed a sex discrimination case, another a race discrimination case, and the two of them, you know, from time to time would have conversations at the desk of one of the women. And the other person at a certain point found tapes in the supply room, and when she thought, oh, I wonder what this is, and put it in a tape recorder, it turned out to be her voice and her colleagues. Their conversations were being tape recorded and edited. Only certain portions of their conversation were on the tape, and they were things that had to do with their feelings about work or the other woman's private conversations with her spouse on the phone. You know, this it had to do with the activation device of a microphone that the woman whose desk it was used to report traffic on the radio. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that makes you feel like you're living in Big Brother land. I once had a debate with the head of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the head of the Airline Association, which is heavily monitored, particularly the reservation clerks. And it was myself and someone from the Machinists Union. And the guy from the chamber kept saying that they use this to get rid of subjectivity among supervisors. And we said, well, we're all in favor of getting rid of subjectivity among supervisors, but you don't have to spy on people in order to do that. There are other ways. And finally, the guy turned to me and said, Ms. Bravo, has it ever occurred to you these are our phones and our companies and we can do with them whatever we want? And I said, yes, it's occurred to me many times, and I appreciate that you're finally being honest about it. So, I mean, really, I think when push comes to shove, this is a form of control and intimidation, and that smart managers know there are lots better ways. If what you really want is to improve productivity and quality, this isn't the way to do it.
Now, I spoke earlier today to Renee Jankowicz, who is an organizer with the International Union of Operating Engineers, who's organizing at the Starbucks plant that was mentioned in my introduction earlier in Auburn, Washington. And she told me of a case of a production worker at Starbucks who very quickly after the installation of video surveillance cameras in the factory there, she started experiencing severe anxiety and paranoia and a constant fear of whether there were hidden cameras in addition to the visible cameras, and whether they were voice-activated. And so within a short time, she not only quit her job, but she moved out of the city that she had lived in. And I wanted to go back to Dr. Paul Landsbergis from Mount Sinai School of Medicine and tell us, how does this fit into a larger picture of health effects of this type of surveillance?
Sure. This type of job stress, as I mentioned, is not only connected with high blood pressure and heart disease, but people's reports of anxiety, tension, depression, and fatigue on the job, and also with physical symptoms such as numbness or soreness in the wrists, pain or stiffness in the arms or shoulders, those types of symptoms connected with repetitive strain injuries. We think because people are being pushed to work faster with fewer rest breaks, this type of monitoring is designed to try to control employees' work time, squeeze extra time out of the day. So it certainly shows up in a variety of health complaints, physical, psychological, and so on.
Dr. Landsbergis, I'm sorry. There seems to be some sort of a problem with the phone line. We're going to call you back on a different line, okay?
Okay.
So we'll be right back with you. In the meantime, let me turn back to Ellen Bravo of 9 to 5. And ask you, what is the status of legal rights of employees to to be in a workplace that's not under surveillance? Do workers have any rights?
There's two ways to look at this. There's a limited legal right, but mainly this is about power and about organizing. The limited legal right has to do with a law that was actually a wiretapping law that says that they can't listen in on what is clearly private conversation. So if they get on the phone and they hear you talking to your partner about some private matter, they have to hang up. And if they feel that you shouldn't be using the phone for private calls, that's a separate matter. They can deal with that separately. But they can't listen to the content of your call and then use that in any way against you. And if you're not sure about your rights and or want tips on how to organize, 9to5's toll-free number is 1-800-522-0925, 522-0925. The reason I say that mainly it's about organizing, there have been attempts to change legislation and give workers more say over monitoring, but mainly the gains that have been won on this have been won in union contracts where both the right to monitor includes notification, the workers have the right to be notified, and there's limits to how the information can be used. It can only be one factor, not the sole factor for discipline, et cetera. I mean, one of the most unnerving things is that you suddenly get a note saying you were rude to your 24th caller. You have no clue who that caller was or what the content of the conversation was, and very little ability to dispute it. So we really want to see that this device is used in a much more circumspect way. But as I said, the main gains have been made by unions, and, you know, this is one of those things where collective action is much more likely to get results.
I think we're now rejoined by Dr. Paul Landsbergis from Mount Sinai, and I'd like to ask you to give us kind of your closing thoughts on both what are the types of problems that are being seen in your clinic, your occupational medicine clinic up at Mount Sinai, and what steps employees can take to protect their health if they're faced with this kind of surveillance.
Yes, we're seeing a lot of problems from poor ergonomics and repetitive strain injuries as a result of those. But in addition, in situations where people are working increased overtime, people are faced with downsizing and layoffs that we've seen over the last 10 years, and the increased work for the people that remain, these types of stresses and pressures seem to increase the risk of the repetitive motion injuries and also contribute to other types of health problems, the psychological symptoms I mentioned, as well as high blood pressure. I did want to emphasize that these types of surveillance systems, the camera surveillance you talked about, listening in on phone calls, are some of the forms, but these days with new technologies, they're being able to use, for example, global positioning systems, satellites, to track truck drivers, package delivery drivers, ID badges equipped with infrared or radio capabilities can track employees working in a hospital, let's say. So this type of monitoring does extend to many different kinds of jobs, and it does seem to increase the stress associated with these jobs.
And as we wrap up, Dr. Landsbergis, can you tell us, if someone called your clinic with a job stress problem, what kind of services are available there?
Right. There are physicians and nurses and other experts in occupational medicine who examine and treat people who have work-related health problems, whether it's exposure to lead, asbestos, poor ergonomics, or job stress.
Okay, and the address and phone number for
sure.
The Mount Sinai Occupational Medicine Clinic?
Sure, it's Madison Avenue and 97th Street, and the phone number is 212-987-6043.
Okay, that's 212-987-6043.
That's
right. For Mount Sinai Occupational Medicine Clinic, and
yes.
I want to thank our guest, Dr. Paul Landsbergis, Assistant Professor of Community and Preventive Medicine at Mount Sinai, who's also associated with that clinic. And finally, I'll give the last word to you, Ellen Bravo of 9to5, about what people can do when they're faced with these problems and, again, how to get in touch with your organization.
Yeah, I just want to say we appreciate the work that Dr. Landsbergis, both the research and the treatment work. And, you know, we feel that what we'd like to do is see that it's prevent it before it happens by limiting the intrusion of these kind of devices, and we encourage people to work together to do that, and we can help keep you informed. 1-800-522-0925.
Okay, I want to thank you, Ellen Bravo, for being with us today, and I want to thank engineer Michael G. Haskins. Special thanks to production assistants from Aniruto Das and John Riley. If you have comments on today's program, you can call me at 212-209-2954. That's it for this edition of Health Action. I'm Bob Lederer, and until next time, as Bernard White likes to say, stay strong and pay close attention.
You are tuned to WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM, listener-sponsored, commercial-free, community radio at 99.5 FM. Coming up in a moment, Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton. Do stay tuned. Or as some of us like to say, 59 minutes past the hour of 2 o'clock. And coming up in a moment, we'll be... Yeah, where is that? Okay, that's right here. We'll be Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton. Hugh Hamilton is in studio and has guests lined up for you. And we'll be taking your calls, I am sure. And the telephone number is 212-209-2900. So make a note of that. Coming up next, Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton. Please do stay tuned.